Well, as our first speaker, I'm very pleased to welcome Anne Harding, who's the Director of the National Centre for Social and Economic Modelling at the University of Canberra. Anne joined the Centre as the inaugural Director in January 1993 and is Professor of Applied Economics and Social Policy at the University of Canberra. During the past 13 years, Anne has led the development of highly sophisticated micro-simulation models and databases so that policymakers can gain much better information about the likely distributional impact of current and proposed policies. Moreover, recently Anne has steered micro-simulation modelling in Australia beyond its traditional tax and social security focus to such new areas as health, aged care, housing and regional issues, with the goal of extending sophisticated quantitative decision support tools to policymakers in these areas. This research is largely being financed through ARC and NHMRC grants. I think with a background like that, we should make Anne an honorary actuary. Anyway, I have much pleasure in inviting Anne to be the first speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. So I'm going to give you a quick overview of the dimensions of population ageing in Australia and what it means for the government so far. So many of you, as your actuaries, will know all about this, but one of the key problems or key reasons why we have population ageing in Australia has been the baby bust. So the dramatic fall in the average number of children born by each woman in Australia, about 3.5 for my mother's generation, down to 1.8 now for current generations. And this is what that looks like when you follow it through time. So this is going back to 1920 up to 2010. And the key thing this brings home to me as someone who tries to model and project our futures is really just what a challenging task that is when behaviour can change this quickly. That's an enormous social transformation that you're witnessing really in that graph. But here we see the birth of the baby boomers. So the baby boomers were born between about 1945 and 1960 in that huge post-war baby boom. Everyone had delayed having their babies during the war. And that bulge in the cohort has been driving trends ever since. And they are now, of course, getting very close to retirement age. And so that's one of the key reasons why we have major population ageing problems in the next 10 to 15 years. There will be large slabs of the labour force actually retiring. And this is the other key driver of population ageing here, that we're just living so much longer, mainly due to advances in medical technology. And for someone from social policy, this is fascinating because when they introduced the age pension, most men would be dying within a couple of years of reaching age 65. You know, there weren't these fiscal problems created for society by having to finance and fund people's retirements for decades after they reached the official retirement age. They were just going to die. Whereas now, we still have not changed the official age pension age, still 65 for men, but they could be living for a decade or two, and given what may happen, 3 decades after that age. And so you can see we're still expecting further increases in life expectancy in the future. So when you put those two things together, you get a major shift in the ratio between the working age population, the taxpayers, the people who are still able to provide services and pay for them, for the retirees, the people aged 65 and over. So back in 1960, we had one retiree for every 7.3 working-aged taxpayers. We go forward to 2040, that is a dramatic shift. So now there's 2.4 working-age Australians for every retiree. And one of the things that's particularly concerning government is that it's not just that there's growth in the proportion of the population who are aged 65 and over, but there's also very strong growth in the old, you know, age 75 and over. And the reason is that the old cost a lot more in terms of health and aged care and pension outlays than do the younger old. And these are the official ABS population projections going forward from 2007 out to 2040 in the blue lines, and this is by age group. I mean, what's so striking is that there's no real forecast increase in the number of Australians aged below 40. No, there's just not much change. For kids, there's almost nothing as well. Whereas there's these huge changes. This is 60 to 74-year-olds, set to go from 2.5 million 60 to 74-year-olds now out to 4.5 million by 2040. Again, a huge change here for 75 to 84-year-olds and a tripling in the number of 85-plus-year-olds who, to government, spell lots of dollars. And our government, you know, with, and we must give them full acclaim for this, have been among the world leaders in trying to understand what this sort of population ageing will mean for their future fiscal positions. So we're not alone in population ageing. Right throughout the OECD, pretty well, they have these same population ageing fiscal pressures coming. But the Treasury actually did this intergenerational report back in 2002, which when it came out, people like me were dancing on the table, because before that we had been giving government reports about what the pressures might be from population ageing, and people were saying, oh, it's a bit gloomy, a bit dim. And when this report came out from the government, from the Treasury, that put this whole raft of issues on the policy agenda, and we were all able to start talking about them. So that was fantastic. But this was the initial conclusions from that intergenerational report. So this is health outlays, the first set of bars off to the left. This is proportion of gross domestic product that the Commonwealth government was expected to spend on them. So gross domestic product is just the size of our economic pie, the size of all economic activity in Australia. And you can see they were forecasting that health would double, Commonwealth spending on health would double as a percentage of GDP over those 40 years going out to 2042. And a bit of an increase for aged care, 1 percentage point of GDP, a bit on pensions, because we have got the pension thing reasonably under control. So the key problem was healthcare costs and how they were going to finance those. And in fact, when the Treasury report came out, everyone thought, oh, that's a bit gloomy too. It can't really be that bad. And the government then got the Productivity Commission to do its report on the implications of population ageing. And the Productivity Commission also went a little bit further than Treasury and looked at what it meant for state governments as well. For states, it can be very serious because they're in charge of the hospital budget. And hospitals are one of the big areas of blowout when you get this expansion in the old. And these were the projections from the Productivity Commission, and they were just as gloomy, if not slightly more gloomy, than were the Treasury numbers. So, again, going out to about 2044, this was the difference between government taxation revenue, or sources of revenue coming in, and government spending going out. If you made reasonable assumptions about what was going to be happening to mortality and immigration and so on, and you assumed that government programs remained unchanged, broadly speaking, to how they are now. And so what they concluded for the Commonwealth was that the gap, the size of that gap between revenue coming in and expenditure going out, was going to equal about 6% of our economic cake, of our GDP, going out to 2040. And you can see we gradually slide into that position. So it's what this means is that for the country as a whole, it's like we're living on our credit card debt. And the credit card debt is getting steeper and steeper. You know, we're declining further into debt. And also you can see much the same picture when you went out through time for the states. Now, of course, governments can't let this happen. So what does that mean? So they spelled out some of it. That it means either that future generations have to pay higher taxes, or we have to cut what government is spending. There have to be adjustments made to spending programs. And the Treasurer underlined how you shouldn't think that 5% of gross or 6% of gross domestic product is a little bit, because 5% of GDP in 2042, which is the gap, the fiscal gap that they're projecting that we have, is the entire amount that they currently spend on health, right? So this is not a little gap, it's quite a big gap that they're needing to take policy measures to correct. So that's government, and really that's being driven by health and aged care costs. But the other part of it that they're very concerned about is what population ageing means for economic growth, how fast our whole economy grows, and for the labour market. These are male labour force participation rates. The red line is the total, and it has been going down in recent years, as many of you know. But the key point to take away from this is that older males tend to work less than younger males. So older males in their 50s and 60s are less likely to have a job than younger males in their 30s and 40s. And when they do have a job, they're more likely to work part-time, so they don't work at the same flat-out rate that we all do in our 20s and 30s. And the implication of that is that as a greater slice of our male population are older, then there'll be relatively fewer people wanting jobs. And in fact, there's just one line here. These your screens aren't very big, so I apologise if you can't see these graphs, but this purple line down here at the bottom is 60 to 64-year-olds, and you can see there's been a pickup in the male labour force participation rate of 60 to 64-year-olds over the past 5 years. And this is fantastically positive. If we can get older males and females, the baby boomers, to keep working into their late 50s, into their 60s, we can ameliorate a very large proportion of those future fiscal problems that I pointed out to you. So what happens with that group is absolutely critical. This is female labour force participation rate. They're the opposite to men, so women have become gradually more likely to have a job over the past decade or two, and that's expected to increase. But nonetheless, you can still see in that purple line at the bottom that older women are still less likely to have a job than younger women. So you have that same phenomenon of the fact that there are more old women in the future compared to young women driving decreases in how many Australians want a job. And this is from the Productivity Commission report showing you what happens to labour force participation rates out over the next 40 years because of this population ageing. So this is what they say would have happened if we hadn't had this phenomenon of structural population ageing. So we're about 64%, probably would have gone up to about 66% of working age Australians being in the labour force. But instead it's going to go down. There's going to be fewer people who want jobs. And this is another way of looking at that same issue. So for all of you who are employers and are currently feeling the squeeze of labour force shortages, it's not going to get any better. It is, in fact, going to get worse. The competition for workers is going to get much more intense. So you can see that if we go forward sort of over the next 20 years, we've got about 2 million or so new workers coming in. If we start here, we've only got 1 million workers coming in over the next 20 years after that. So very slow growth in labour force, much slower than we have been used to in the past couple of decades. And what does all that mean? It sort of means we've been having an economic party here over the last few decades. So Ken Henry, the Secretary-Treasury, said over the last 40 years, we've had the size of our economic pie has grown at 3.75% a year. You know, it's been good times. The champagne corks have been popping. But over the next 40 years, things are going to grow a lot more slowly. The whole size of the economy will grow more slowly, down at 2.25%, he suggested. Now, that's what it means for government and the economy. The other side is what it actually means for the baby boomers who are retiring. And these were some estimates that we did in the AMP NATSEM Income and Wealth Report series, which I know these figures will be familiar to many of you, but which I found quite alarming. We were looking at what the accumulated assets were of these are 50 to 64-year-olds. At the time we did these figures, they had total wealth of about $240,000. And there were a couple of problems with it. One problem was that more than half of that was held up in the family home. And the family home can be quite hard to tap into as a source of funding to fund your healthcare needs and your living expenses in retirement. Although I know that's being rapidly addressed now with reverse equity mortgages and so on. And they may have been terribly unpopular with our parents, but I think it's very clear that the baby boomers are going to embrace these reverse equity mortgages in order to finance the continuing of a good standard of living in retirement and not worry about leaving money to their kids. So we're seeing that behavioural or attitudinal shift coming through now. I mean, the other problem is they didn't have enough superannuation, and at the time there was only average estimated super balances of $56,000. And this is the other problem. So for all of you who look at averages for cohorts or different age groups, when you look at wealth, it's really important to understand that the distribution of wealth is fantastically skewed. You know, it's much, much more skewed than the distribution of income. And so this is a very typical sort of profile that you get, really no matter which age group you look at. And what this showed was that the wealthiest quarter of 50 to 64-year-olds had almost 60% of the total wealth of all 50 to 64-year-olds. Right? And the poorest one quarter, the least wealthy one quarter of 50 to 64-year-olds had only 5% of the total wealth of the group. So what that pie chart really shows you is that, you know, generally speaking, about half of a cohort are going to be going into retirement with almost no wealth behind them. You know, it's just a very unequal distribution. There's a group who'll be okay, but there's a very large group who'll be going in there to 2 to 3 decades of retirement with very few assets behind them. The other thing we did was to have a look at early retirees. So as many of you will know, there's been this trend that has really alarmed government of people retiring early. There's a bit of a phenomenon of people retiring early, going on the dole or the disability support pension, spending what little assets they do have in the expectation of going on to the age pension once they hit 65. And when you look at, this is from the wonderful HILDA data that we now have some data that follows people through time, which has been wonderful for all of us who do social policy. When you look at these early retirees, it's really clear that a large proportion are retiring. We don't know whether this is voluntary or involuntary retirement. It may be that these people have been retrenched. But a very large proportion of them are retiring with nothing behind them. No assets behind them, really. So the red ones were 50 to 54-year-olds. This was their income. Almost two-thirds of them had a personal income of less than $10,000 a year. So basically they were on income support, the social security system. There were very few on high incomes in retirement. So that was their income, and this next one was their superannuation. So two-thirds, the blue bars were 50 to 59, the red are 50 to 54. Basically two-fifths of early retirees had no superannuation balances at all, no super nest eggs to support them during this period. There are a few there, as you can see, about a fifth or so, who have superannuation nest eggs of $100,000 or more. But on the whole, early retirees are throwing themselves into the arms of the taxpayer and praying, really. They're banking on the fact that, you know, taxpayers are going to continue providing age pensions and subsidised pharmaceuticals, subsidised healthcare and so on at the same rate in the future as we do now. And, of course, the government are worried about this. They're desperately trying to persuade people that they should be working longer, they need to stay in the labour force and not retire early. And this is the Treasurer saying, is it fair for people to retire, run down their assets on an overseas trip or extending the house so that they can then go on a pension? Now, this is very interesting. This is, if you're a government and you're very concerned about population ageing and people working longer, then they have to be healthy enough to be able to work longer. And so that whole, this is one of the key drivers behind the recent COAG human capital agenda. So we now have all levels of government in Australia trying to concentrate on improving health, essentially, so people can be more able to participate in the labour force and not retire early. And this just underlines for you that very strong link between health and age. So this was the proportion of the population with one, at least one disease, effectively, one of the diseases that have been identified as the top diseases in Australia. There are some differences by income. You can see low-income people are a bit more likely to be sick than higher-income and middle-income people. But the key thing is the slope of that line. You know, that as you get older, you are much more likely to be sick. And what governments will now be trying to do is flatten that line to the extent that we can, or bring it down for all age groups, so that for people in their 60s, health, poor health, will become less the reason why they have to leave the labour force. Now, I was going to talk to you very briefly. You're David, aren't you? Yes. So I did this partly for David Knox, because he had contact with us about a decade and a half ago when we started trying to do this sort of modelling of the future. So I want to talk to you quickly about what's wrong with the current approaches the government are using to project our futures. So in the Intergenerational Report, although that's been landmark, and the Productivity Commission report, they've been excellent pieces of work for looking forward through time about what population ageing means for government. But what they can't do is look at distributional impact. So if, for example, people are going to have to pay more taxes, well, who's going to pay the taxes? And what does that look like between the generations? How do we ensure there's generational equity? As the baby boomers are there in their retirement clamouring for the price of seeing the doctor to remain very low, and those poor working-age individuals with kids are saying, please give us some childcare. Right, so there's going to be all these generational tensions to keep taxes low and, from this point of the working age, and expenditures high. So that what we're trying to do now is build what are called dynamic microsimulation models, where we shift an entire population forward through time, person by person. And we're a little bit behind in doing that in Australia. These models are now being used very actively in policy development in Europe, the States, and in Canada, because they have similar population ageing problems to ours. And in fact, the impetus for some of them has been that their problems are much more serious than ours. So in places like Norway, their old age pension system is literally going to send the country broke if they don't reform it. So they have had, it's going to take up 30% of gross domestic product, you know, in the next 20 to 30 years. So they have to reform their systems, and they're using these sorts of models to do that. Anyway, we've now got a 5-year grant to do this type of modelling with 13 Commonwealth departments as our partners. So when this is finished, this will be a model that the whole Commonwealth uses, and through NATSEM will be available to other Australians as well for looking at future policy options. So what we do is essentially start with a census sample and then circle around person by person, year by year, and make happen to them all the sorts of things that happen to you and I. So they get a year older, maybe they die, they might have a baby if they're female, they might go to university, they'll progress through education, they'll get jobs and lose jobs, they'll get sick and recover, and so on. They'll spend money, they'll pay taxes and receive social security and use health services. So we're going to be projecting forward the circumstances of Australia for about 50 years, like that. So it cycles around like that year after year. So the purpose is to try to flesh out the answers to questions such as who's going to pay the extra taxes, how much extra tax can people afford to pay of working age, what sort of pressures will the different generations be under. And so the goal is to try to make sure that as a nation we introduce the fairest and most equitable policies that we can. And this is just very quickly to show you what some of the government's responses to population ageing have been so far. So this whole thing about we've got to get people to stay in the labour market, you know, we have to get them to work longer. And so, and in part, of course, it's also not just people of retirement age, and so many of you would be aware of the recent welfare-to-work reforms that the government introduced in the last budget. So there's a big focus on getting people with some disabilities and sole parents off welfare and into jobs, and there's been that whole focus on workplace and industrial relations reform as well. As Malcolm said, they're doing things to reform superannuation. I'm on some of the committees where they're trying to persuade employers to look again at being more flexible in employing older workers and people with disabilities. So they need employers to stop being fussy, as fussy, about who they will employ. So in the next 5 to 10 years, you will desperately need to have these older baby boomers kept in the labour force in all of your companies and where you work. So you'll have to reform things like letting them work more flexible working hours, work part-time, fit in with their superannuation arrangements and so on. But you just will need them because they will be one of the key sources of workers. There are just not going to be these young Australians coming through at the same rate that we've had in the last couple of decades. We've had some immigration, and it's a bit of a solution, but it's only very partial because the rest of the world are in the same boat as us and everyone's trying to get immigrants. And obviously there are some things they can do on the age pension front. We've been fascinated to notice in some of this longitudinal data that we now have available to us that some people on reaching age pension aids trade their house up. So they buy a more expensive house, even though the kids have finally left home. And that's because the house isn't taken into account in the pension means test. And so that's a sensible way of keeping the assets, but still getting off the public purse and becoming still staying eligible for age pension. And the one we haven't really tackled here, which is still an absolute no-no on public debate, and I'm actually wondering if there are media here, is that we haven't really talked about whether the retirement age has to go up. So some of the other countries have started looking at this. The US is talking about putting it up to 67, I think might have legislated for it. There's debate about it in England. In some of these European countries who are reforming their social insurance systems, they're now having links between as the actuarially expected length of life increases, they're going to split that between retirement and expected working years. So they're going to translate a proportion of increased years of life into a higher retirement age. So none of that is yet on the policy agenda here. It's all just much too sensitive for us to discuss, but you think it might have to come. So the bottom line from this is that huge baby boom cohort really sliding so close to retirement now. Some of them have already retired. They've retired early. You can see that a quarter of men and a half of women are retiring before age 60. The government is trying frantically to reverse this trend, and there has been some success. So in the last few years, the participation rates of these older groups have been picking up a bit, and the aim is to get them up further. And when we look at their circumstances of early retirees, it is clear that many of them have not saved enough for a comfortable retirement. It's going to be particularly a problem for women. You know, we go forward 20 years, there will be this raft of poor, old women, you know, with very little behind them. And saying to baby boomers that they should work a bit longer and perhaps save harder is a very unpopular message. There's some recent research from the Australia Institute said that they were almost vehemently angry whenever anyone suggested that retirement ages had to increase. But we do still need to keep debating these issues as a society because they probably do. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Anne. I can't think of a better way to set the scene for our seminar. We now have 15 minutes time for questions from the floor or comments from the floor. I've been chairing professional meetings of the actuaries for most of this year, and this is always the hardest part, the very first question. So who's going to help me out and ask the first question? Thanks, Ray. Yeah.
Do we have to say who we are?
I think so.
Ray Murray. My question is, have you done any modelling that involves assets and houses and the price of houses and, you know, will the wealth actually be there if the baby boomers and the trans, you know, because wealth just disappears. It only exists while people have a demand for it. So has any modelling been done that to integrate that into the demographic shift as well? Do I make sense?
Actually, a couple of really interesting questions there. When we look at things like the Household Expenditure Survey, you know, there's this theory that people save their money during working life and then run it down in retirement. Well, the current older Australians are about the only group of Australians who save money, like whose income is higher than their spending, both of which are very meagre. Right? The rest of us are all living on credit cards, really. But I think that will change in the future. So I think the baby boomers are going to go into retirement with a whole different set of expectations. They're not thinking about leaving this nest egg for their kids. They're going to spend it. You know, that spend kids' inheritance now mentality. And they will, I think. And in fact, people who do housing forecasts are really worried about what that will mean for the children, because, like, maybe your mum dies, and instead of getting the home as a nest egg, you get the debt that they now owe the bank due to the reverse equity mortgage because they've lived so long. And there's some concern about that happening in Japan, where the prices of houses have gone down relative to what's been paid for them and the mortgages. But another set of questions that you're sort of relating to, I think, is what will happen when such a large group perhaps are trying to dispose of their assets in retirement. And there's been a United States paper that caused sort of shockwaves around the world, where they predicted that there would be a steep decline in house prices as the baby boomers reached very old age and started trying to offload assets, or they died and the houses were tried to be offloaded. It's been such an alarming paper for so many people that there has been a lot of subsequent academic research on it. And the consensus at the moment seems to be that house prices will grow more slowly than they have, but there won't actually be a collapse. But it's a pretty uncertain future. I know some of the banks are scoping this, trying to work out the risk attached to their future portfolios in the face of this huge population bulge moving through the system.
My name's Ron Dean. I was just wondering if
there's a microphone there. Thanks.
Sorry. I was just wondering if there are any really hard-nosed people in the Treasury, of course you'd expect it, or in NatSem, who say, oh, look, the problem is self-correcting. If governments don't have enough money to provide health, and if people don't save enough for their retirement, longevity will decrease.
Well, obviously the Treasury haven't said this, but I have heard talk about euthanasia coming back onto the policy agenda.
Yes, Alan. Thanks.
Alan Merton. One of the things I'm interested in is your comment about the retirement age, which I think you're right, needs to get on the agenda. But a question relating to health. We've got a fair prevalence of small business, sort of owner-operators, sole traders, and we hear anecdotally in our business that it's not quite voluntary retirement. It's I'm too tired to continue running the small business. So how do I sell the business and get out? Because I can't actually wind back a business that I own. I'm interested in whether you've done anything that says whether 65-year-olds today are actually much healthier than 65-year-olds 10 years ago, or 65-year-olds in 10 years will be much healthier than 65-year-olds today, or whether we've just actually deferred the last years of life and the sort of end of life is longer, but the person at retirement age is actually no healthier, really.
Yeah, that's a really critical question, isn't it? I haven't seen good Australian data, but my understanding of the overseas data is that everyone's surprised that people aren't reporting they feel a lot healthier. So often on these health things over time, all we have is self-reported health status in, you know, separate surveys through time. And my understanding is there hasn't been a big, like, 10 percentage point improvement in the proportion who say, you know, I feel really good. And that self-reported health status has been shown to be a very accurate guide to how likely you are to either get sick or be sick or die. It's well correlated. And my impression from looking at the circumstances today is that people are consuming, like, huge amounts of pharmaceuticals, like for quite a very large number of years before they get to that final year or two before death, which is, as you say, there's that, it's called the compression of morbidity. There's a theory about this huge blowout in health expenditure on older Australians is really all concentrated in the year or two before you die, rather than being, you consume a lot more health resources for 15 years, the extra 15 years of life. But they're still debating it, as I understand it. It's not clearly resolved. But I absolutely agree with you about small business people working very long hours. I was really struck by an earlier report we did last year about working hours for both employees and small business people, and it looked as though employees had taken the economic growth of the last decade in the form of not working massively longer hours. There'd been a bit of a reduction, you know, in the very long working hours. But for small business people, that hadn't happened. You know, they were still working incredibly long hours, a very large chunk of them. And right into retirement, what you'd normally call retirement ages too, like right up to 75. And
yes.
Thank you. Anthony Asher. I've done a fair amount of reading on this subject in the last couple of years, and it seems to me that it's not really a good idea to get too pessimistic. And the first thing is that seems to me that future retirees must be better off than current retirees because of the super guarantee, the impact of the super guarantee. And secondly, is it seems, when I read the research around the world, that retirement ages have been dropping, in fact about 15 years lower than they were 100 years ago, and that retirees generally feel better off than they were financially, on average, than they were when they're working. I mean, the amounts of money look meagre, but the spending structure, all sorts of things change after retirement. So it seems to me that retired people are happier and better off than non-retired people. But having said that, I do think it's important that we do turn around the drop in retirement age, and it's very encouraging to see that it's happening. Now, the research I've read has showed that the higher the more generous the pension scheme, the younger the retirement age. So people retire when they've got enough money to retire, or they perceive they have. But the fact is that when people retire, they're actually unhappier than they were previously, not because they don't have enough money. Sorry. Although they have enough money and they're happy on the money side, they are lonely. 22% recent Ameriprise survey that I saw, 22% of retirees were surprised that they felt lonely after leaving work because it's actually not much fun. But we've got this attitude that you've mentioned, that retiring is a good thing. And that because people actually start planning, I think they start planning for retirement at about 40, hoping that they actually will be retired before they're 60, while they should be planning for retirement at 55 or 60, expecting to retire at 70, because that's what happened 100 years ago. And if people were doing that, they would be actually happier than they are now.
I'm sorry to hear that, because I was pinning my hopes on the fact that older people seem to have reported higher levels of happiness than younger people. So I was thinking, despite the fact that physically things might deteriorate a bit, your mental happiness goes up. But now tell me the first question again. What was that one?
No, I mean, isn't the point that we don't really need to be worried about the finances. The real issue is there is this problem of increasing the workforce, and that it really is a question of attitude more than finance.
Well, it depends. The only reason we wouldn't be worried about the finances is if the baby boomers in old age were going to be content to accept the sort of standard of living that their parents have in old age. So when you look at the statistics about the incomes on which older Australians survive at the moment, you know, the overwhelming majority are on incomes of less than $10,000 a year. They're on the age pension, right? And when I show those sorts of figures to Gen X and Gen Y, they react with absolute horror at the thought that they are going to live for 30 years or 20 years on less than $10,000 a year in today's dollars. And the baby boomers do too. So I think the problem is that the baby boomers have these expectations of what their life will be like in retirement. And if they haven't saved the money to finance that, then they're going to try to make taxpayers finance it. And so, for example, I was talking about similar issues to New South Wales government CEOs, and the head of the New South Wales Department of Ageing and Disability said they were already having a lot of problems with with expectations rising. So that, for example, the baby boomers were saying to them, I don't want to be stuck in a nursing home and having a cup of tepid tea at 6 a.m. You know, I expect you to to deliver me a cafe latte to my home at 9. And that's fine, so long as you can persuade someone to pay for that, which is either them or taxpayers. And so I think there will be that intergenerational tension, because younger people will need help with the kids. They'll need, you know, childcare and education services, and many of them will be squeezed. You know, they'll be sandwich generation, so they'll be responsible for children at the same time they're responsible for ageing baby boomer parents. So, you know, we'll see elder care start to become as significant a policy issue as childcare is now. So there'll be these intergenerational debates, which effectively get resolved at the ballot box, about the balance of taxes and spending between the different generations.
Mike Barker, just a follow-up question on early retirement. And most of what you've said, with a few qualifications, and most of your charts imply that early retirement is mainly voluntary. Yet if you look at the third bullet point on your chart, most of these early retirees haven't got any money. What that tells me is that most of them are involuntary rather than voluntary. And that certainly coincides with my personal experience, which is mainly in the white-collar occupations, financial services, business services, property. But there's an enormous amount of retrenchment going on in the 50s. It's very hard for someone over 50 who's just been retrenched to find a new job. And going back to Anthony Asher's comment, after these people have gone through 100 interviews and got 100 knockbacks, they don't spend the next few years in a very happy retirement. Now, my view used to be that as labour shortages developed, the invisible hand would sort this out and people would realise that they couldn't get young workers, so they'd employ older ones. I'm having second thoughts about that now, because it seems to me there's a subtle form of ageism at work here, that most people would rather have employ people who are younger than them, because they can tell them what to do, or they can manage them, or they can mentor them, as the case may be. So you tend to get a hierarchy where each person has 6 or 8 or 10 reports who are all younger than him or her. And there's a tendency for chief executives to get younger. These days, chief executives are generally in their 40s. They used to be in their 50s, but they're moving down to the 40s. Perhaps a number of them are in their 30s now. I'd like your views on whether that ageism is permanent, whether there's anything you can do about it. Is that something we ought to be thinking about?
See, I think all that is attitude, and the bottom line is that those attitudes will have to change. And the government has these major campaigns now to try to change those attitudes among employers. You know, I've been part of the very active publicity strategies and marketing strategies. The PM talks about this stuff in his speeches to industry, that they have to start looking at older workers and workers with disabilities, workers who've been on welfare for a long time. You know, you have to start looking at these as groups who you will employ. And in part, that change in attitudes goes back to the question this gentleman raised, which was that when we had high unemployment, it seemed good that people retired early. We thought that people in their 50s were taking the jobs of younger people, and so we didn't worry about the fact that many of the old age retirement systems in Europe and to some extent here had incentives to encourage people to retire early. But that's all changed now. So in Europe, they're trying frantically and are making and are reforming their systems to eliminate any incentive to retire early. So that will change too. Not only the balance of financial incentives to make you work longer will change, but there'll be ongoing active push by government, and presumably, you know, groups like CEDA and the industry associations will pick it up as well, to encourage attitudes to change as well. So on the demand side for workers, for older workers, that should change too. And the government, of course, is doing the stick approach as well. So they're taking the stick to people on disability support pension, because, you know, that's where there's been this huge blowout, partly, as you say, in people in their 50s.
We've reached the time for the next session to start. Anne has another appointment which she has to go to, so she will be leaving us. But just before she goes, could we all thank her for her tremendous talk and the way she's answered the questions.